KQED.
Welcome to this KQED Public Radio Public Affairs Special. I'm Molly Samuel. On November 14, 2012, a program entitled An Evening with Google's Executive Chairman was presented by the Computer History Museum in Mountain View. John Holler, president and CEO of the Computer History Museum, was there to introduce and speak with Google's Executive Chairman, Eric Schmidt.
The story of how Eric Schmidt came to be chairman and CEO of Google in 2001 is the stuff of book-length articles and book-length books. I Googled Eric using his own product today, and I got exactly 43,900,000 search results back. The one on top, of course, was the one I was looking for, because that's Google's goal, as we know, and it was surrounded tastefully by relevant advertising. So my little search contributed to the roughly $11 billion that Google will earn in this quarter. It would be hard to imagine more than 10 years ago someone better suited to the job of helping Google grow up than Eric Schmidt. A PhD in computer science, a software engineer and scholar, a background in startups, chief technology officer at Sun Microsystems, CEO of the big networking company Novell, and most importantly, as co-founder Sergey Brin later said, he was the only candidate they interviewed who had been to Burning Man. Tonight we will explore with Eric what he's seen and done in the Google Revolution, a decade of history-making and invention at one of the most remarkable companies of our time. And we'll talk about his vision for what's ahead. Please join me in welcoming Eric Schmidt.
Thank you very much, John.
Welcome.
Yeah.
We're so glad to have you here.
Oh, thank you. And before we begin, let me just say I really appreciate you all supporting the Computer History Museum. You know, Gordon Bell founded this 15, 20 years ago, and when it ultimately was relocated here, we were able to really get the most amazing collection of the history that most of us have lived through. And so for me to go through the exhibits and go, oh my God, I didn't realize how ugly it was or how slow it was or whatever. The only quibble I have is that at the opening you said you have to turn off your phones. Turn on your phones. We love our phones.
So we won't bother with the ringtones or anything else that happens, right? So long as people are tweeting and posting and...
It's a mobile world, guys. Get used to it.
Of course, absolutely. Let me start off just, you know, in this little film that we showed beforehand, you're talking about the Burroughs architecture. Did you ever figure out what it was about, maybe not that, but a piece of technology like you were just talking about that was really deeply meaningful to you in shaping what you... pursued?
I think this faculty member, who was Bob Fabry at Berkeley, who's since retired, was actually trying to teach me an arrogance lesson. I don't think it was about facts at all, because I was really sure that this thing sucked, and I had a much better design. And he was trying to teach me a lesson that I would pass on to you, that there was some really smart person who really thought this was really good, and maybe I should understand why before I just willingly attack them without any basis. My architecture, by the way, was better, but theirs was good too. And I learned an important lesson about humility. Our industry tends to attract very smart, very arrogant people who want to change the world, which is great, right? But let's have a little respect for the people who preceded them, who were trying to make the world a good place too.
Let me start off by asking you, if you remember the first time you encountered the World Wide Web and what you thought about it and what it meant to you at that moment.
I remember it quite well because I was at Sun, and this was in January, roughly 1992. And we had finished a series of announcements at Sun in the networking space, and I remember meeting with my team and saying, pretty much everything that is going to be invented in networking has been invented, sort of a typical error. And I was quite convinced of it because I could see nothing new or interesting aside from improvements in bandwidth and improvements in router technology, which Sun, by the way, had managed to invent some and then give up because we weren't focused on it, so I was quite annoyed about that. And I remember sitting there thinking, you know, it's sort of calm and boring. And then John Gage had discovered Mosaic, which I think everybody understands is the predecessor of all of this, and came in and gave a presentation of this, what was essentially a link structure in a directory. And we said, oh my God. And of course, it's to Tim Berners-Lee's credit that he invented this, you know, while he was at CERN. And what's interesting is that I remember sitting there at the time saying, why didn't we invent this? right? I mean, that's our job, right? We're supposed to be the innovators. Why is this random guy who I don't know, turns out to be brilliant, but that's a separate discussion, you know, sitting in outside of Geneva do this? Because we had all the precursors. We had all the necessary. We were busy, if the technical people will remember that you were basically moving FTP files around and opening them up. And we had, you know, the Usenet link structure and so forth. But it was a leap of genius from Tim that did it. And another lesson that you learn from that is that often innovation occurs from outside the industry, even your own, right? Which is always a shocking fact, especially for us.
So let's skip ahead just a bit from there to 2001. Search engines had been around for a while, and Google certainly was not the first one to the party when it came to search.
In fact, Google would say we were the last. Right. We were.
You were.
We were. There were many fine choices beforehand.
So in that context, what was it about Google as a proposition that really seemed attractive to you?
Well, I actually didn't think Google would account to much, so show you how smart I was. As I understand what was happening was that the predecessors, AltaVista and the other search engines that were present at the time, were relatively easily biased by clicks. And so this was early in the development of the web, and it was sort of accepted that if you wanted a higher ranking or better treatment, you would just click more. Now, if we look at it in hindsight, that's obviously a wrong strategy. So Larry and Sergey, and in particular Larry, developed the PageRank algorithm, which is independent of click rates. In other words, the rankings are not determined by the number of times that you click on something. And that that strategy gave a differentiated solution. And I suspect that they were also helped by the fact that they started out at Stanford. They had a lot of very, very smart friends who were sort of among the cognoscenti. The fact that the accuracy was better spread, and it became a word-of-mouth phenomenon.
Then, at that same time as you were starting to look at that technical side of it, in your specific discussions with Sergey and Larry at the time, as they were thinking about bringing someone in, everything that's been written makes it very clear that the chemistry has been important from the very beginning. Did you have a sense of that as you were going through that whole process?
They were unusual, but I was unusual too, is the way I would understand it. So they had been searching for a CEO for 16 months before. And the board had agreed to do the search, and they'd hired a very successful recruiter to run this. And they would haul these people in, and they would barrage them with questions. And their strategy for interviewing people was to spend a lot of time with them. So you had to go skiing with them. Right, which I refused, although I liked to ski. It just didn't seem relevant at the time. But they were very concerned about fit as well. And it turns out that although we were divergent in age, we had a very common underlying basis of history. Jeff Ullman was my faculty member at Princeton. He was also Larry and Sergey's faculty member here at Stanford. We had pretty much the same personal, social, executive, and technological views. And so when you meet people like that, you don't really have a choice but to work with them. And sort of my advice would be, when you meet somebody who's that alter ego, don't let them go, right? Find a way, however crazy and however weird, to make them part of your world and you. Because the benefit of having a partner in a business context is completely undervalued. We have this sort of myth that the executive, the sort of, you know, smart executive who makes all these unilateral decisions and is so incredibly smart. But if you look, every company, even the iconic companies, are led by teams. And the best way to do that is with highly bound partnerships. And what I learned in working with Larry and Sergey was that we would fight very, very hard over issues, but there was not a moment where there was any question as to their motivation or mine in terms of making the company successful. We had complete goal alignment. And that is such a great thing in life.
And it's been that way from the beginning.
Yes, it was always.
Yeah.
And in my case, I didn't even interview anywhere else. I just knew. And again, I would encourage you, if you find yourself in this situation, jump. Because it's so personally successful. You integrate your families and your life and your social, you know, all the things that you care about. And something really fascinating is going to happen. I was personally skeptical of the success of the company. I thought this ad thing, like, is this going to work or what? In fact, when I first started as CEO, I actually insisted that the finance people come and show me the capital accounts and the cash accounts, because I was concerned that there was fraud going on, because people couldn't really be clicking these things. But indeed, they were. And I learned very clearly and very, very well that these ads were extraordinarily valuable. So again, I was wrong, and the rest took off.
I want to talk about that ad thing here in a minute, but just a couple more questions about the early history and your thinking about it. You have a PhD in computer science.
That's correct.
Was that important to you as you were first moving into the company? You know, there's this sort of phrase about someone having the chops to do the job, and I just wonder if having that PhD and having done what you did was important in the early days as you onboarded
with,
and
with respect
went
to Google, I'm not sure it was the degree was important. It was certainly important to be technical to understand the challenges. And one of the great things about computer scientists is that we're trained around scale and replication. And so Google at the time, and today is still true, is really about sort of a community of people moving in synchrony with an awful lot of freedom to innovate. And it takes a certain kind of training to understand that that's how you win and that you have to tolerate failure and so forth. And the way you build growth quickly is through scale and sort of allowing the sort of growth to occur naturally and very, very quickly.
And then there's this Googliness that people have within Google. That word has come to define the culture. How early did you understand being Googly was really a value? Well,
Larry and Sergey talked about it a great deal, and I assumed that it was a marketing ploy on their part, and which is fine. You know, marketing is fine. So after a few months, I was sitting in one of the conference rooms, and I would come up to speed, and I understood issues. And there was a discussion over a particular interaction between search results and ads. And these are complex issues involving, you know, what kind of data can you use and so forth. And one of the engineers pounds his fist on the table and says, "That's evil." And it was as though a bomb had gone off. Because I had never seen this kind of behavior. I was used to, I'm going to use the term digital equipment corporation, sort of horizontal, sort of, they're hierarchical, but they're still team-oriented, which is sort of roughly what the way Sun was run. So the fact that this thing was bottoms up and that somebody could literally felt empowered to do that, I think showed it. At exactly the same time, I walked into my office. I had a little tiny little 8x12 office, and I discover I have a roommate. And this nice gentleman who identifies himself as a meat. And I said, "Well, hello." And he goes, "Hi, you know, I'm your new roommate." And I said, "Okay." You never, you know, Google, you never fire. You always listen first. You know, you're never quite sure what they're up to. And so I said, "Amita, you know, how are you here?" And he said, "Well, you know, my office had 6 people and you're never here." And I said, "Okay." And I said, "Did you check with anybody as to whether, and by the way, we're talking about his table's here and my table's here." And I look at my assistant who's out in the hallway, and she gives me this, "I don't know what's going on" look, right? So like, it's one of those things where it's, you're in a new culture and you don't quite know how to behave, and said, "Okay, so who, did anyone suggest that you might do this?" He said, "Yeah, I checked with Wayne Rosing, who's the VP of engineering, who works for me." And he goes, "Wayne suggested it." And so I go, "Ah, this is Wayne's practical joke on me." So the problem is, at this point, you can't kick the guy out. So I said, "Okay." So we sit next to each other, and I mean next to each other, like this. And he's an engineer, and he puts his headphones on, and he programs. And I'm busy doing whatever I'm doing at the time. This goes on for a few weeks. And, you know, every day, because I come to work, you know, we work hard, 12 hours a day. We don't really talk to each other, because he's busy, and I'm busy. And one day, I'm on the phone to Omid, who's running sales. And Omid goes, we're having this argument over revenue, and I still remember the number was, Omid said the revenue is going to be $121 million. And I said, "Well, how do you know that?" You know, we're having this conversation. So we hang up the phone, and Amit, who's my next-door neighbor, literally right here, takes his headphone off and says, "I know what the revenue is." And I go, "What? You've been listening in?" He said, "I listen into all your conversations." I go, "Okay, thank you for..." You know, he's an engineer, so he tells the truth, right? So I said, okay, Amit, thank you for letting me know. And so I said, well, what is the revenue number? He says, it's going to be $142 million. And I said, how do you know? I'm in charge of building the systems that produce the revenue projections. And I said, you are? So if you're going to have a roommate, this is by far the best roommate to ever have, your CEO. Keeps his headphones on, tell you the revenue number, because revenue is everything. So I said, okay. And again, in Google, you know, you sort of don't act. So I said, okay, how can I use this information? So Omid calls up, and I said, Omid, how are you doing on the quarter? And he says, revenue's getting better. What's it at? 132. I said, good, good, good. Is there any evidence of sandbagging in your organization? And he goes, no. I said, good, I'm glad to hear it. I would never want you to sandbag and give me a number lower than the number you're going to hit. And he said, our systems are producing 132. And of course, he was using a different and less accurate system than my engineer. So this goes on, and eventually, of course, it's exactly 142. So we bought a large sandbag, and we made Omid make all of his presentations standing on the sandbag. And Amit and I became best friends, and we were office mates for actually years. We could not continue this after we became public because of materiality. And he's a great human being. That's googliness for you.
That's a great googly story. You know, Stephen Levy found Amit. Stephen Levy found Amit when he was writing In the Plex. We had Stephen here last year to talk about it, and he asked Amit, what's the number one thing you learned from Eric? And he said, I learned I would never want to be the CEO.
Really?
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about how Google does what it does. And I'm going to ask you a question that we talked about just a few minutes ago, and I'm really curious about the answer, which is, think about 2001 and the technology that existed when you started Google then, and think about the technology you're using today. If what existed today had existed back then, would you have done Google the same way? How would you have done things differently?
I think the biggest change would be that all of our first attempts at programs would be on a mobile device and not on a web device. So if I go back to 10 years ago, what was the story? It was HTML 2 or 3 and the various DSS and other sort of CSS standards and so forth at the time. And we optimized around that platform. This was before the technology that ultimately would allow things like Gmail. So this was before JavaScript would allow you to build these sort of powerful web apps. So today what we would do is we would have gone straight at building these powerful mobile apps using these sort of new technologies. And of course we'd have a lot more bandwidth. But I think the other aspects of our approach, which are the core algorithm that we use, we would use exactly the same. And we would certainly do the same advertising model because we were fortunate that by moving to this ROI-based database system, we really did produce a huge revenue growth. I have another story for you. We, one weekend, we decided to make a database transition, which was called Project Drano. And it's a pretty big deal in a small company. We didn't have a lot of cash. So what happens is I come in on the Saturday and the Sunday to see what's happening, and I walk over to the engineers, and I say, what are you working on? They said, working on this project. And that's great. Why are you not at the data centers? And they go, we've never been at the data centers. And I said, you're just about to do the most important transition in the company, and you are not there to watch and make sure these servers stay up? Said, no, never occurred to us. So today, you would build Google on top of one of these extraordinarily set of cloud computing services, and it would happen much faster as a result. Google has had to build all of the infrastructure to handle these complex web services, deal with denial of service attacks, deal with replication, complex things involving the SQL databases, and those all those things are now well established. We would just occur faster.
Is this the equivalent of a pivot for you? Are you constantly having to change a huge amount of the underlying architecture? I mean, it seems like it's like trying to change the tires on an Indy car as it's going around the track.
I think it's fair to say that Google's infrastructure goes through these cycles which are 2 to 3 years old. And they go something like, the key scientists invent a new way of doing what we call sharded file storage, where you can spread the files in an even more sophisticated way. Google is all about sparse matrices, large numbers of entry matrices of information, which are we do math over. to do ranking and things like that. We're constantly coming up with sort of new ways of doing that. We invented a particular way of organizing all the computers to give us the answers back. Again, that's now popularized in the public eye in something called Hadoop, which is open source technology, which does something similar. We, again, have version 2, version 3, version 4 of all of those systems. So I'd say it's fair to say that we have one of these every 2 to 3 years, and I suspect that will be always true. Every system, another example, for years, the Gmail infrastructure was on a database system that stored all of your attachments and so forth. It was incompatible with the database system that stored all of your search results. And there were complex technical reasons why. And I remember one day Larry decided that he was fed up with this, so he got all the technical teams together and asked each of them to present the reasons why their database approaches were correct. And of course, there were 12 approaches, and everyone had exactly the reason they were right and why everyone else was wrong. And I remember him coming back to me and saying, I don't know what to do. You know, how do I get this sorted out? And of course, Larry, by sheer force, you know, went in and sort of got these teams to sort of put together this sort of scalable architecture, and we're now on a common one. So this phenomena where you have divergent systems, which you then have to unify by one level of abstraction, I think is characteristic of computer science. I would tell you that this opportunity continues to be true in cloud computing in general. Today, there are large numbers of startups here in the Valley and elsewhere that are essentially rebuilding UI tools of one kind or another, various forms of storing data, et cetera, and somebody's going to come along with new infrastructure that will standardize that, and then they'll become even more productive. So the consequence is that today, if you're starting a startup, it takes a few programmers, you can rent or buy all the infrastructure, you never meet your servers, like I was trained to when I was a younger executive. And in fact, if you founded a company today, you would not have an IT department. You would use a combination of the cloud computing solutions and the Google App solutions. It's all you'd ever need.
You said something a minute ago that I just want to follow up on, which is that Sergey will go in and start to make some of these things happen. There are so many stories about his active involvement in so many different aspects of the company from a technology standpoint. Is that rare in your experience? Is that unusual? Do you find this to be just an exceptional aspect of the way Google works?
I would say it is normal in the most successful companies. If you look at the history of Apple, Intel, Oracle, Microsoft, there was a key technical leader or a couple that would go in and drive change. One of the things that happens with engineering teams is they get sort of used to their own sort of structure and thinking, and sometimes you have to push and push hard to get people to sort of merge their views or combine their approaches or so forth. And that's one of the arts of engineering management in all tech companies. In my time as CEO, it actually worked. It was actually remarkably easy because Larry and Sergey would run ahead. Literally, by the time I had arrived at something, they had already been through and rationalized these. And that's why our partnership has worked well so well for so long.
Let's talk about that ad thing that you were talking about a few minutes ago. Can you describe the aha moment when you learned advertising was going to be as incredibly successful as it has been?
I mentioned this transition in Project Drano. And
Project Drano?
Who knows?
Why was it called Drano?
God knows. You know, some 23-year-old named it. you know, it's fine, whatever. And so I remember I mentioned that we did this transition over the weekend. We did it successfully, and it was a key decision in the first year was we had 3 separate advertising systems, and we combined to one. And we, of course, moved to the one that was the riskiest. And the system was designed by a product manager, his name is Salar, who now runs YouTube, by the way, and who was one of the true heroes of Google by virtue of having invented all of this. And at the time, he was, you know, 23 or 24 years old. And I remember first walking up to him and said, you better not screw up because you're going to bankrupt this company. And he looks at me, all of 24, and says, not to worry, we'll be fine. And I go, okay. And of course, he was exactly right. We made this transition to this new model, which had to do with the way the auction worked, and our revenue began to grow very, very, very quickly. But for the first few weeks, we had forgotten to do some of the systems that you need to deal with customers, in particular revenue reporting, click reporting, and so forth. For some reason or another, I had flown to New York, which is where advertising was run, to meet with Tim Armstrong, who an exceptional sales executive now running AOL. And I was meeting with Tim, and then I had a little cube where I was doing my work, and I'm overhearing, it's 5 o'clock, and I'm overhearing a young woman who's in our ad sales department who's in the cube next to me, and sort of loud in a New York sort of way. And, okay, I'm listening to this. I'm sorry, we don't have your report. I'm sorry, I know. You know, and it sounds like there's some death or something. So this goes on for maybe 20 minutes, and so I go over to this young lady and I said, I need to know what's going on, you know, and she said, he calls me every day at 5. I said, why? She said, if the company that he's in depends on the clicks that day, if I don't have the report to him at 5, he may lose his job by 6 or 7. And I said, what? He said, you don't understand. You've always worked in these companies with all this cash. Most businesses are hand to mouth. We gave them the cash to make their payroll, and we're not telling them how much. He doesn't know whether he should lay off people. And then she goes into this, you know, sort of, you know, sending his sort of guilt chip to me. And I go, I got it, right? So I got on the plane, flew back, and we got the reports out. But it was a lesson that things which we think are toys, they're interesting and fun, and we use these are essential. So from that moment on, I understood that Google was not some interesting technological experiment, but it was rather something that was deeply embedded in how people got paid. The accuracy was important. I remember Sergey getting a letter, which he showed me very proudly, from a fellow who said that Thank you for saving his life, because he typed, I'm having a heart attack, and the first result was, you're having a heart attack, call 911, these are your symptoms. And the ambulance said that if he hadn't called them immediately, he would have been dead in, you know, five minutes later. So you understand all of a sudden the power of information is not just some interesting academic thing, but it's fundamental to people's lives, their privacy, the way they operate, the way they get paid, how they grow, and all those things.
And then as far as Google's own business model goes, those of us who are old enough to remember Lycos and AltaVista and all of those other search engines, we were quite used to seeing paid search results pop up, which were absolutely irrelevant to what you were searching for. But fairly early on, Google unlocked the fact that you could combine advertising and search and a business model for Google that was unlike anything that had ever been done. When did that become clear?
Again, a story from the first year. You know, I sort of get it as a new CEO, and I kind of understand. I'm trying to run everything. And Larry likes to look at how the product works. And so he gets increasingly upset with our ads. So because they weren't very good, in his opinion. So he takes a series of queries which he thinks are representative. He types them in. He prints them out on a piece of paper in the whiteboard in the break room. And he writes a note saying, these ads are terrible. Can you guys critique them? So for the afternoon, right, everybody is busy critiquing them. Well, that's a stupid ad, or this should have been a different, or the ordering was wrong. Then he writes another note. And the other note says, can't one of you guys fix this? I thought, now this is going to be really interesting. This is the founder just wrote a random note in the break room. You know, normally you would like call the vice president of engineering, you know, and the directors of engineering and all that. Didn't do that. So I figured, okay, we'll see what happens. This is a Friday at 5. I was doing something else over the weekend, and I came in Monday morning. The problem had been solved. A set of engineers who were not in the ads group at the time had thought it was a really interesting question, and they invented the algorithm over the weekend. That's amazing. So then, Larry and Sergey decided that they didn't like the engineering management that had not done this. So we decided to do a disorg, which was to become disorganized. And I thought, oh, this is going to be a disaster. So
this is a formal thing. This is a term of art, a disorg.
Well, it was, you have to name things in order to, you know, to implement them. So I said, okay. So we ended up reorganizing things so that one of our executives had 121 reports. He is an extraordinary executive who now works as a venture capitalist. And I would say to him, how do you do on your one-on-ones? He said, oh, I try to not have them. And so the hardest thing to have 121 direct reports is writing the reviews. But he managed to pull it off. Eventually, we got the right management and the right kind of culture set.
I'm going to ask one final question about the past, and then we'll move on to today and especially tomorrow. Larry, I think, was famous for saying, Larry Page, that Google's ideal in search would be if the engine knew exactly what you were trying to say when you typed in your search result, and it gave you back exactly the thing that you were looking for, and it did it every single time.
Actually, Sergey actually suggested that we should, that was Larry's proposal. Sergey's proposal was that there would be some sort of thing we screwed into your brain. And I said, Sergey, would you stop? And of course, he was joking, just for the record.
So how close are you? We're not going to be screwing things into our brain anytime soon, but how close are you to Larry's original vision?
We're getting there. It's a race, because what you forget is that the information explosion is all around us. Something like 97 or 98% of the content that's now on the internet is user-generated. So if the user would stop generating all this new content, which of course is not going to happen, I think we could get closer to it. But the fact of the matter is it's a race between increasingly sophisticated algorithms that are hard to describe but are magical against this extraordinary increase in data. We think our algorithms are by far the best. I think most people agree. But we're always being critical. Last year, we had about 500 improvements to our search algorithm. You don't see them because they're incremental. But when you understand the challenge that the other end says, the amount of incoming, you'll appreciate how difficult the ranking problem is. You have to take, as you pointed out, 50 million things or 100 million things and rank them so that there's a 1, a 2, a 3, and a 4. And you have to do that in milliseconds.
Okay, data. Let's talk about data for a minute. It's only just now, I think, becoming clear, at least in the popular media, the role the data played in the presidential campaign. And you were embedded for many months with the Obama campaign, and the stories that are coming out now are just fascinating about the way data worked this time around. Can you talk a little bit about that, what you saw and what the influence was?
Yeah, when I was not doing my Google stuff, I was working with Jim Messina, who's a personal friend, in Chicago on the campaign, on the infrastructure, not on the policy issues. And the infrastructure can be summarized as a cloud computing platform with mobile apps to mobilize people, with backups that you'd print out, with heavy use of Google Docs, Google Spreadsheets, and Google Maps, which I was very proud of. The wonderment of a political campaign, and I think this is true of both the Republicans and the Democrats, is that these are, in this case, each side spent on the order of $1.2 billion over 18 months. They hired in the Democratic campaign, I think, on the order of 5,000 professional people, and they had on the order of 1.5 million volunteers, all of which culminates in activity on a single day. The technology that was used in data was roughly the following. There are these things called voter files, which are produced by the secretaries of state. And I did not know this, but that information is public and updated quite frequently. So your voter history, and not who you voted for, but that you voted, along with your address, typically your home address, as well as a few other identifying things, is in fact available. And so both campaigns used that data to build essentially a profile around people. Start with the voter file. And most of it, people have gotten this message wrong. Most of the information was information that you volunteered. But what happened is you would log in, identify yourself, and then the computers would match that to the voter file, and then they would do a score. And the most interesting thing is that if the score is zero, then you're probably going to vote for the other side, so we're not going to spend too much time on you. If your vote is 100, score is 100, then you're probably going to be a volunteer, and we're not going to spend that much time on you. So the targeting was around people who were likely to support ARC side, but who needed some inducements. And to give you an idea of how ridiculous this can get, people would have their doors knocked on 6 times. Like, after a few times, wouldn't you, like, decide to vote or not? Right? And I was told that people like to have a conversation. And, of course, because of the extraordinary amount of money in the campaign, people were subjected to 50 or 60 political ads every week that they actually saw, for which both campaigns spent literally fortunes and enriched the TV industry no end. So the data analytics was an integral part in both the targeting and our understanding who the voters were, and then what is called get out the vote. And get out the vote is ultimately a volunteer who has what is a walk list, and they walk around a little neighborhood and they knock on doors and say, can I help you? Do you need any help getting to the polls? And so forth. And I think most of the analysis indicated that this technology gave the Obama campaign a couple points of advantage, which was enough to take swing states. And I don't know why, by the way, as a country, we have decided to only have 5 states elect our president, but that's a separate discussion. And thank you all for voting here in California, but I'm not sure it mattered. by the way, I was joking. Please vote anyway. And say the same thing in the Republican states. But the fact of the matter is that this enormous focus did ultimately produce strong wins for the president in the campaign, and I think that technology was certainly part of it.
I think I read a story where on the Sunday before the election, someone in the campaign was getting some intelligence, and the Obama campaign was getting some intelligence from the Romney campaign about the campaign had knocked on 55,000 doors that Sunday to get out the vote in Ohio, and it was alarming. And the president happened to walk in at that moment, and this 55,000 door-knocking story was going around, and someone turned to one of the people working in data and said, tell him the door thing. And he said, well, I wouldn't worry about that too much because we knocked on 343,000 today. Is that the kind of disparity there was at the end of the campaign?
Another thing that the Obama campaign did particularly well is register new people. One of the things that you saw on television, and it was interesting, by the way, to see the actual data versus what the television people said. And they didn't have as good engineers. You know, they didn't have the real science behind it. But if you look at the Obama campaign managed to get better turnout among young people than they did in 2008, which was one of the sort of the memes that everybody assumed would be false, and that was not. In fact, it was greater turnout and huge registration gains. And, you know, I would argue registering to vote is a good thing, regardless of party.
Now, along these same lines, you're just about to publish a book, aren't you, on technology and diplomacy. Is that the subject?
It's hard to describe what it's about. It's about what the world is going to be like when 5 billion people join us to our party. Book should come out early next year. My co-author is a guy named Jared Cohen, who now works at Google. He's a brilliant young man who worked in the State Department. It's not primarily a technical book. It's more about what happens when everybody has mobile phones. And we spent a lot of time discussing how governments will react to it, and our core thesis is governments have no idea what we're doing. Right? The impact of empowering citizens is going to revolutionize the way governments interact with their citizens. It's almost all good, by the way. So it's clearly an optimistic message, and there's a number of cautionary areas.
Can we do a book launch here at the museum?
I'm sure.
Let's do. Increasingly, the consumer world seems to be dividing up into a quartet of Amazon, Apple, Google, and Facebook. Would you agree with that assessment? And if so, roughly, can you all coexist together? Is there enough room for everyone? How are we as consumers going to be affected by this coalescence?
The point of the four is not that there are four, it's not that the specific companies, but that there are four as opposed to one. All of us grew up with either an IBM dominance or a Microsoft dominance. I've, of course, grown up with both. And we've never had a situation where we had four extremely well-run, tough, smart, global, scalable, very rich companies that are vying for a declining cost business. So one way to think about it is think about it as the contest between the four. I'll give you the numbers about Android. So do a little plug for Android while we're here. Android is lighting up 1.3 million phones per day. Industry estimates are that the scale of Android is on the order of 4 times larger than the iPhone infrastructure. An iPhone is quite good, by the way. We have more than 500 million Android phones installed, and we have more than 700,000 apps, which roughly rivals the number of apps in the Apple App Store. And the competition between the two, and of course Apple has a great story too, produces amazing value for you. Think about what's happening over this brutal competition between these two companies and the back and the forth and the screaming and the lawsuits and so forth and so on. You're winning. Look at Amazon, and which has clearly done a fantastic job in building the world's largest store, not just bookstore. And then think about all the partnership programs and what Apple's trying to do and what Google's trying to do to compete with that. You benefit from that in terms of fast delivery, no sales tax, no payments, what have you, no shipping charges, et cetera. And now people are getting into same-day delivery. Who funds this? Competition. Look at Facebook, which has now a competitor in Google+, which is doing quite well and sort of, you know, coming up at them, forcing them to both open up their strategies as well as focus on their monetization and serve their customers. In each of these cases, they are network platforms that scale enormously. In defense of Apple, and I was, of course, proudly on their board for 3+ years, they have many, many important partners above and below their ecosystem. Well, that's also true of Google. It's also true of Amazon. Amazon is a platform for resellers. So many people now put their products through Amazon to get them to you. And Facebook, of course, through Facebook Connect and the Open Graph, has a similar partnership strategy. We've never had four like that. Now, we can debate whether there's a fifth. People have argued that it should be Netflix or it should be Twitter. It's interesting people don't argue that it's Microsoft. But that's sort of the nature of things, that the architectures move forward. And I think the four are fantastic value. It's a real pain, right, to be in one of them, because the other guys are really good. And so you can't use the classic strategy of we're just smarter, we won't talk to you, because the other guys are just as smart, just as capable, and feel just as strongly about how well they're serving their consumers.
In this era of emerging mobility that you talked about just a minute ago, and all four of you are rushing to that platform, what are you learning about the way we behave? What are the things that you're finding out about us that are influencing your business direction? Not only what your competitors are doing, but what we're doing.
I think it's early to say that. We're busy empowering all of us with devices that can be used for this information. There are complicated privacy and data uses issues which are still not fully worked out. We're trying to be conservative about that. The most important fact that's true now toward the end of 2012 is that for normal people, and I would claim I'm not normal, so I'm excluding myself from this, people who don't spend all day on a keyboard, you find that the combination of the phones and the tablets pretty much replace your need for a PC. To me, that's a shocking thing to say. If you'd asked me that 2 years ago, I'd say, no, that's not going to happen. But we have a lot of evidence that people's primary computer in the non-knowledge worker, you know, sort of the normal people, not people who are tied to desks, certainly not programmers or what have you, they can get pretty much what they need done. And they prefer it because it's more convenient. I'll give you an example. I use Google Maps. I use a Mac. I have Google Maps on my Mac or any PC. Why does my Maps not show me where I am? Oh, it doesn't have a GPS. Why doesn't my Mac have a GPS? Oh, it's not supposed to be used outside. It gets wet. You know, but once you get used to having an accurate GPS signal, you say, why doesn't my map show me where I am? I'm using that as an example to talk about convenience. Now, I'm of the generation of guys that thinks that instead of tinkering on your car, you just build your computer. So for me, the fact that you have to wire your GPS and plug everything in and so forth and build everything by hand is perfectly good. It's what I occupy my free time on. That's not normal. Okay? People actually want their car to just work. Turn it on and it just works. So what's happened with these mobile devices is that the standard for consumer utility that just works is so tough now. And again, to criticize the four, each of the four, and in fact most of the other large companies, are still in a web to mobile transition. I was talking to the CEO of Live Nation, right? Something like 60 or 70% of the tickets that they sell are now purchased on phones. I said, you've got to be kidding. And I said, no, here's how it works. It was interesting data. Concerts are always sold out immediately. People always have their phone. The alert comes on because there are services which tell you, you know, XYZ group, your favorite group is going to perform. They sell out within 5 minutes. Boom! You just bought the ticket because you know somebody else is going to compete with you. That point is a generic point, I think, of how our world will evolve. we're always going to be connected.
There are some wonderful questions here for you as someone who's been through the ultimate startup and who also worked in a more traditional setting before you went to Google. So let me just see if I can pick one that summarizes what clearly young people in the audience are curious about. Could you give three, if there are three, most important lessons to us young programmers who aspire to be a CEO or a CTO of a big technology company?
I think that, well, there's a number of lessons. I think the first is that you won't be successful by being a general purpose person. In this market, which is so competitive, you have to be really good at something, and you have to build your credibility with that. I was fortunate that I was a programmer and an engineering manager and in these really narrow areas, and so I built my experience, but I started from a small but important and successful area. And I think all success ultimately starts from something small, and you look back and you remember that that was what you did just as hard as what you do now is. So that's sort of the first comment. I think the second comment is that most people, when they conceptualize what they're doing, understate the opportunity that technology provides. I've been guilty of this forever. One of the geniuses of Larry and Sergey was that they would always seek the impossible. Sometimes they were wrong, and I would argue with them, but overwhelmingly their ambition in terms of the impact that they could have, they saw farther and faster than others. And so I think if you can spend some time trying to imagine what the future will like, it will occur quicker than other people think, and if you can ride that. And I think the third thing I would offer is that it's no longer a loner game. I went back earlier to the comment about teams. If you can find somebody who you like to hang out with and who's smarter than you are, right, and admit it, there's at least one person in the world, right, smarter than you, hang out with them. Try to work with them. Try to, even if they're kind of crazy and wacky and so forth, and they're kind of insufferable in the way that crazy people can be, but try to, because they're going to change it. They're not going to accept the traditional things. And I think the transition from, the way I would describe it is, if you look at the, over my 30 years at this, almost all of the management through the end of the 90s was sort of traditional. I'm going to use digital equipment as a, it was a particular model of hierarchy and a way of making decisions, a way of pre-announcing products and managing your businesses and so forth. It was all thrown away by this new and, by the way, younger generation than myself, executives. It tells you that every assumption you make in technology can be overthrown by the next generation, which is why these jobs are so interesting.
And do you have a point of view about startup versus big company as the first place that someone might go to find these exceptional people to be a mentor or a model?
I think you can find them in both. The startup cycle in our valley is a series of waves. You know, the funding magnifies. You have a huge number of things. There's a lot of copycats and so forth. But out of those failures come some of the greatest life lessons. You know, the best CFO you can hire is one that went bankrupt, because that's the one thing that's not going to happen again, right? They're going to understand, you know, money. Within, as long as they didn't go to jail or something. You get the idea.
We have a terrible shortage of engineering talent here in the Valley and in this country. What should we be doing about that?
Well, we could actually reverse the stupidest policy of the entire U.S. government. Anyone know what it is? The H-1B program, right? Here's what we do. This is such a brilliant strategy. Let's get the smartest people in the world, bring them to the United States, educate them to their teeth, and kick them out, because we don't want them here. They might pose a danger. But I digress. It's got to be the stupidest policy in the world. If you look at, certainly in the U.S., and we have lots of stupid policies, so it's a tough test. If you look in here in Silicon Valley, the evidence was that 40 to 50% of the startups are done by foreign-born and particularly Indian-born entrepreneurs. The wealth, the creativity, your house price, everything you care about is completely dependent upon us fixing this. And for 15 years, we have been complaining about this. And in fact, every year the government finds a way to make it harder. So it tells me that at the end of the day, the political leadership of our country is not in agreement with us that the way that you build great wealth for America is you let people be creative, You hire as many people as you can, you have ruthless competition, and you build global businesses. And that's how strongly I feel. Everything that you all can do to put pressure on our government on this is helpful. It's probably the single thing that each of all of us can do to address this problem. There are many, many other things we can do, but I find it offensive that we would treat these people so way. Companies like Google and the others that I've named, all condo people. We actually keep them in Vancouver and in Zurich and places like this. And we wait for the October 1st date to arrive, and we pile them all in, and then we move them into the country. This is madness. I can go on. I think my position is clear.
And is there an educational component to it as well, Eric? I mean, we have the policy concern about these visas. And then what about just training a new generation and more of them to think engineering is a pursuit?
Well, first place, the generation that's coming out of the universities here in America are shockingly great. I work with them every day, and the sooner we can put them in charge, the better. Right? They're smarter, they're more global, they work harder. I think they're more socially knowledgeable, they're more socially adept, they're more environmentally concerned. I think in many, many ways, they are the greatest thing ever produced here in the United States. Because of the way our system works, they will get in charge. I think that's wonderful. I'm not sure what else we should do besides recognize that real innovation comes from the next generation that comes through, and we celebrate it. It's interesting that the Silicon Valley, the structure, the economic structure, has produced. So part of the reason this occurs is that the companies that were successful before serve as a marker for those people to go off for their fortune and their success.
We have large numbers of middle school students come through the museum during the summer who are part of a Google program that is specifically designed to take eighth graders who are interested in math and science and get them excited about it. Are you a little like Alabama or LSU? Are you looking, as a company, are you looking down the road at engineers that far ahead of tomorrow?
Great programmers start at about 12 or 11 these days. It's shocking. And Larry, I think, started at like 7, just a separate discussion. So it breaks out early in our industry, I think largely correlated with math and science skills. To answer this and then the question before, you might imagine, since it's always fun to ask the president what you would do differently, and this president, who I obviously support, has focused on STEM education, science and math education, and a commitment to the facts and a few other things like that that actually matter. There is something that we could do and that he and the country could do that would materially affect this. And I think it would be to make a national commitment to increase the amount of, I'm going to call it, use the word, analytical training to the level that you find in the Asian countries. The fact of the matter is that for whatever reason, our educational system does not produce as many engineers and as many, I'm going to use the word, analytically trained, so economics, things with numbers, essentially, in one kind or another, as many of the Asian models. And we compete with them globally. So we can complain all we want about China and Japan and Korea and so forth and so on. And by the way, when you go there, they have all their own problems. It was a separate discussion. But there is something we could do, which is to shift the educational priorities in this country to increase the number of analytical trains. I figured over a 5-year period, you could shift it by about 10%. And that would roughly, and this would have to be a sort of a moonshot type of approach, that's probably the best thing that the current president could do to ensure that successor and successor and successor will see huge economic growth. If you look at globally what the problems are in the world, you have a problem of demographics, because you have too many old people, not enough young people, to support the income needs of the older people and their medical needs. You've got a problem of globalization, because it means you can't raise prices. And you have a problem of automation, where the low-wage skills are being replaced by machines. The only solution that I can come up with, maybe you all have other ideas, is education. And especially in the fields that are needing. In our industry, there's a huge shortage, which is why this H-1B thing is so stupid. But the fact of the matter is, we would be a stronger country if we trained more analytically capable people. I think we've got the wealth model. I think we've got the innovation model nailed. We are the winner in a global sense by far. Everyone's trying to copy our model, but we're still holding ourselves back. because we're not producing enough of such people. Google has done a small amount of work, as you mentioned, on this, but this is much bigger than what Google and other companies can do. This has to be a national priority at every level.
I'm going to take one more question from this stack here, and then I'm going to save the final one for me. The Google Books project, this is a more granular sort of question than we've been talking about the last few minutes. Where does Google Books stand? Are you encouraged that Google Books is going to realize the original vision for it, and where do you think that's headed?
I hear every day from people who were at 2 in the morning stuck, and because of a Google Books result, they were able to finish something, and they had no mechanism, no place to go to a library to get that answer. I would argue that Google Books and the library project in particular are a tremendous public service. We've been litigated to death over this stuff, largely because I think in the book industry, we were the only change in the book industry in 100 years. And I think we came to a pretty good understanding of how to solve the problems, which are legitimate. And of course, our settlement was then thrown out by a judge, so we're busy working on a new settlement. But I think we'll get there. We also are in the process of selling books. Of course, the book Jared and I are writing will be on Google Books, and you'll be able to purchase it. So I would argue we've done two things well. First, we got the historic information out there, and there's plenty of people for whom the 1890 history of Irish folk dance is incredibly important. I'm not one of them, but that person got their answer at 3 in the morning because they needed it right then and there, and I'm very proud of that. But the other thing that's happened, and Google is one of them, is the fact of the matter is that books are now online. I was shocked, and I shouldn't have been, when Amazon announced that the majority of the books they sell are now e-books. Many newspapers, magazines, and so forth are moving to digital-only or primarily digital circulation models. So the transition is both inexorable and clear. The question is not will it happen, but how will it happen, how will we make it happen? And I think we've made a great public service, and I'm happy about it.
So one final question. Sure. I'm intrigued by the extent to which you talked about policy issues tonight. You obviously were closely involved with the presidential campaign. You're very articulate on a number of public policy issues. Is this an area of growing interest for you personally? Are you hearing the call of policy more and more, Eric?
No, I've actually discovered, when you visit another community, you're initially intrigued by their language. And then after a few weeks, you discover it's the same sentences from 2 weeks before. And then you sort of learn the patterns, and you're not quite so as intrigued. I've enjoyed learning about this. My personal roots are in technology, and I'm most interested in how technology can surprise people and hopefully surprise them for the good. My own personal career has been a constant surprise of myself of what technology could do and the impact we could have, overwhelmingly positive. So I've decided to spend my time trying to understand that. And so I enjoy meeting with traditional political leaders and scaring them because nobody ever scares them. I said, look, the following thing could occur. Are you ready? No, I hadn't thought about it. The following thing could occur. Are you ready? And getting them to understand that we are a force, that we're hopefully a force for good, that we need to be nurtured and understood and paid attention to. And I'm very, very proud of the role and power that our industry now has globally. When I think about 10 years ago, you were asking about 2001, we didn't have this role. And if you want an example of this, look at the SOPA fight, which was February of this year, in fact, where we actually showed that we were an industry of the scale and size of the media industries and just as important, and we needed to be treated with respect. And I like that.
You've been incredibly generous tonight, and with your opening remarks, and with your support of the museum, Eric. Thank you very, very much for being here tonight.
Thank you all for doing that.
Thank you.
You've been listening to An Evening with Google's Executive Chairman, Eric Schmidt, recorded at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View on November 14th. The recording engineer was Jim Bennett. The technical supervisor was Monte Carlos. I'm Molly Samuel. Thanks for listening.